Welcome to Dispatch in Depth, where we give you the stories behind the science of emergency dispatch. This is the official research podcast of the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch, the world's leading authority in dispatch science. I'm your host, Isabel Gardette, Director of Academics for the International Academies of Emergency Dispatch. In each episode, we'll be bringing you stories of the fascinating people who do research in this area. We'll give you their backstory, including how they got there, what they're working on, and what drew them to the research. These are people who represent the cutting edge in dispatch research, and I hope you'll join us to hear more about them. Welcome to Dispatch in Depth. Today's guest is a retired deputy fire chief of the San Jose Fire Department in California. He's a member of the IAED College of Fellows and has served as the IAED Fire Council of Standards Chair since 2007. He's currently a program administrator for PDC and was instrumental in the development of the new Fire Priority Dispatch System, version 7.0. Welcome, Gary Galasso.
Hey, thank you. Glad to be here.
So if we could just start by you telling the listeners a little bit about yourself. How did you get into public safety, and then how did you end up working here?
Yeah, well, it's a very cool story I like to tell because it's been quite a journey of surprises. You know, I was left high school early and got in the military and served overseas and got out of the military and then worked the grocery business. And I was a journeyman clerk and then ended up as a frozen food manager. And a friend of mine says, hey, you want to take an emergency medical technician course? And I said, sure. So I took one. And then a year later, I was a paramedic. And then 10 years later, I started testing for fire departments. So I got on San Jose Fire and 26 years served there.
Wow.
And then completed there, they hired me here. So it's been an incredible journey. I mean, you think of starting in one direction and ending up in another one. It was just amazing. But just that one EMT class, right?
What made you get into public safety? Why did you decide to take that course?
It's funny. People ask me that. And I served in Vietnam. It was infantry. And one of the amazing things they did is they could have somebody who was injured in the field at the hospital within about 15 minutes by helicopter.
Wow.
It was called medevac, and it was just amazing. So when the discussion came 5 years later and says, hey, we're taking an EMT class, that flashed in my head. And I says, you know, emergency services for the United States would be pretty amazing to get into. So that's what drew me to it. And as soon as I got into it, I loved it. I took a very low-paying job, working $2 an hour for an ambulance company, and leaving my very good frozen food manager position for a major chain. It just told me a lot of things that I wanted to do versus making money, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what made you choose San Jose? How did you end up there?
Oh, just looking for the biggest and the brightest and best department. They're one of the most progressive fire departments that in California at the time. And I was testing for many departments, as many young men do. You just try to get into one if you can. And I was just very blessed. I was being considered for one fire department. And then San Jose gave me the notification to come see them. So I did.
So talk a little bit about Fire version 7. What's the biggest news that's coming from version 7?
Everything. I've been following the protocol since we first had the idea. Back in 99, I think it was Navigator, I want to say San Antonio. And the discussion was made that we've been using the medical protocol for years. Why not fire and police, right? And so some work groups from the academy got together and we started saying, why not? So there at that Navigator, they formulated the two initial work groups to get those protocols started, police and fire. Within the next year, they had version one. So we released version one at Navigator, I think it was Las Vegas. And then there's where it all started. And it was clunky. We took the foundation of medical and started off police and fire. And it went through quite an evolution over the last 18 years. Amazing evolutions. Stuff that we found that was not necessary to ask up front. And then we saw the evolution of making echo calls for fires. And that started up about 8 years ago. And the big thing, obviously, was taking structure fires that were called reported structure fires, if you will, that had flame or smoke showing to be an echo as well. Mm-hmm. And we saw that as being a huge thing for the fire service because, again, they're going against the clock there, especially when you talk about NFPA standards and the 1 minute to dispatch,
right,
if you will, for a working fire. Yeah, but I'm just saying, going back to version 7, I have never been involved with such a change in the protocol overall as we've seen with version 7. We've done so many things with that, and we'll get more into it as we talk about the details.
So one of the things is that for the first time in a very long time, there were actually some new protocols added to the version 7, right? So can you tell us a little bit about what those are?
Sure, I sure can. Just to let you know, too, a little background we give people. The processes everybody should be aware of is a proposal for change process actually drives most of the changes in the three disciplines. It truly does. And we got over 200 proposals for change. There's a lot more that came after the initial evaluation. Our Council of Standards to consider these changes occurred in January of 2016.
Wow.
So you can see all the work we've been trying to do over the last 2 years to get this thing underway. And it was like we'd start something new and find a new discovery that you have to change something else. And it was like, you know, when you ask a question, answer a question, you get two more questions, right? The same kind of process we went through for that. It took a long time, but we're very proud of what's coming out.
And the proposals primarily come from user agencies, right? Those come from agencies that are already using the FHIR protocol?
Yeah, it truly have to be relative. Mm-hmm. So they have to know what the protocol is and understand what the importance of that is. You know, so they had to be users of it. And then we see major events that have occurred, and we'll talk about that as well, that actually make change in the way the protocol is. I got to tell you, we'll go more into pre-arrival instructions and the whatnot, but we've, in the realm of using the protocol, and I've been with the Academy for as you know, for years. And I think that we were kind of guarded in how we gave instructions. Hmm. We said, if only safe to do so, a lot. And we wouldn't give a lot of instructions because of the risk we'd put the caller at, not knowing what they would face. And for building fires and structure fires, for example, telling them how to get out of the building when buildings can be so complex when you talk about commercial buildings or apartment buildings or what have you. And so we really, if you will, did not dive into that too much. And we say, find your way out,
right?
More or less, if it's safe to do so. What I, in my opinion, I believe the active shooter protocol broke the glass ceiling of safety. When you're told in instructing and in training that if you are being involved in active shooters as a person, let's say it's subject to that event, then you're either to try to escape or hide. And if not, fight your way out.
Right, the fight survive. For your life.
Yes. And so we look at this now, and we look at many situations applies for fire rescue as well. And so we're seeing situations that we'll talk about in the next few minutes that will give an idea. We've broke the glass ceiling there as well. We want people to survive their plight. And sometimes when it's you got no place else to go and nothing else you can do, we have to give you some sense of things to do in order to survive your plight.
That's fascinating. It actually seems like it's kind of analogous to the original kind of arguments about pre-arrival instructions for CPR, where a lot of agencies thought initially that they would be kind of taking on too much risk by giving CPR instructions. But it really turned out over time to be the exact opposite, that they're really at risk if they're not giving the instructions and not helping people when they can. So it sounds like you're kind of coming to the same thing with the FHIR protocol.
You know, you do make a great evaluation there. We talk about taking the risk and challenge with that. And now it's gone incredibly way over the top when you talk about not just the safety of the individual. Now, looking to survive or find their situation that truly is life-threatening. Mm-hmm. Their environment's life-threatening. So active shooter and trapped in a structure fire, trapped in wildland fire, these things come up now. Now we're giving you the last best chance, if you will, to get out of the situation. You know, so you're right. That was quite an evolution we went through,
right?
You know, 40 years ago.
And it seems like the community's expectations have just changed dramatically since then.
It has. And I think, too, we put the telecommunicator in a position now that actually makes them the rescuer way before the responders will get there. So we're finding the telecommunicators now are the ones saving the lives in those rare situations. And we're empowering them now to actually do something the rescuers have no capability of doing because it's well before their ability to get there. So I think that's incredible.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we'll come back in just a second to some of the new pre-arrivals. But before we do that, what are some of the just new protocols that are available?
Yeah, we're really happy about these. One is backcountry rescue. In situations where we're far off from responding any responders to the scene. And now we have basically identify what the challenge is, what resources have to be sent for long distance, and how to help the person survive their situation. So that's huge. The next one was Lost Person. Now, this is not Lost Person locally in the city. This is Lost Person on the fringes of their environment, whether it's a park environment or a situation in the outdoors. And this is for first and third party callers. So if I'm lost, I call in. If my loved one's lost, I can call in to try to find them.
And so where's the differentiating line then between a backcountry rescue and a lost person? So what if I'm lost in the backcountry then?
Yeah, backcountry rescue actually talks about a situation where a person has fallen into danger.
Oh, I see.
Where they might be a snow avalanche, hanging off a cliff, you know, fallen, injured out there where they now have a problem. Now we have to try to reach them. The lost person is basically haven't faced that yet, where they're just lost. They need to get back to safety or civilization, if you will.
And were there other new protocols?
Okay.
Lots.
We got more. We got one that kind of split out from water rescue. Mm-hmm. We had in 6.1 in earlier versions combined water rescue with sinking vehicle and vehicle in flood waters. So it was more expeditious to process a sinking vehicle flood water call if we split it out in its own chief complaint. So that occurred. Okay. The next one was another split off. In fact, two new protocols came out of the one outside fire. And this was huge. We've got a lot of feedback over recent years of the problems with trying to combine vegetation fires and dumpster fires and windmill fires and treehouse fires all into one protocol. And it, in a way, it causes the fire service some angst because your preparation, your mission, your safety gear is based on what kind of fire you go on. So we heard things coming from agencies where they said, well, you know, we get set up for one type of fire and they'll wear what we call their bunker gear. The stuff you fight structure fires with ended up being in a grass fire and the vice versa, where they'd be had their light gear on and have to go fight some building fire, if you will, that really wasn't a building, but it was a power unit or, you know, dumpster, what have you. So these kind of things create a problem. Also, it was trying to do too much in one chief complaint protocol. We found that earlier years with hazmat and fuel spills. We split that out as well. We found it out in lightning strikes. We used to be in structure fire. We split that out as well. So we've been doing, if you will, or recognizing some needs to kind of split things out to make them more pertinent, appropriate, and allow us to specialize, if you will, and we send a response based on this separate set of conditions or circumstances. So what came out of outside fire was vegetation, wildland, brush, grass fire. I know it's a long title, but let me say that again. Vegetation, wildland, brush, and grass fire. So this truly meets the mission of the fire service in dealing with outside fires when it deals with vegetation fires. And so we see this much needed, and I think the agencies are really going to like this because then now they'll be able to customize responses based on those wildland fires. And you know how devastating they've been over recent years across the country. And so we feel this is going to meet their need quite well.
Yeah, we have a pretty large raging wildfire just outside Salt Lake right now.
I looked on the map today. There's five, actually.
Five?
Stretched all the way down south of Cedar City. So it's quite a few. We're getting smoke in the Salt Lake area for all those listening in today.
Just a quick question on that. So the previous outside fire covered pretty much anything that wasn't a structure fire.
Exactly.
So it could be anything that happened to be outside.
Yes. Well, you know, we have vehicle fires and as a separate protocol and marine fires and what have you. But truly, something that's on fire outside that's not a train, plane, or boat or car, that was handled basically under outside fire. Yeah.
So now you're giving people the opportunity to really drill down into what the specific situation is.
Yes. And here's another one for you. Here's a brand new one called outside tank fire. This was also one of those, you know, I wish we would have caught this earlier because it makes so much sense. And for the fire agencies out there, they can understand this. When you're approaching a large fuel storage tank or you're approaching a tank farm for some of these industrial areas that have 20, 50, 100,000 gallon containers of ethyl methyl bad stuff, if you will, that are 20 or 30 tanks in a tank farm, and those go on fire, you have to take special precautions. You have to have appropriate resources going to these fires. They're huge events and typically long-term events as well. So this protocol allows us to address those issues as they should with its own strategy and its own response configurations to deal with those. So it was just a perfect time to have that new protocol launch.
Do those tend to be events in which there are multiple agencies responding? I mean, is that size of an incident?
Absolutely could be. I remember that we had a, I would have to say somewhere in the area of 500, at least 500,000 gallon fuel storage tank in the California coast, and had been dormant for years. But the sludge of the oil and remnants of the gas, that tank caught on fire, and it lasted for days. We had to call in foam units from outside the area, and we had to do airdrops on it and everything because we could not put it out. And so we see now on some of these larger events that may become mutual aid driven and may need a lot of resources, especially when it comes to hazardous materials and things like that.
Did you say foam units?
Yeah. Typically for fuels, your oils or what have you, to put those fires out, they use what we use in different formats to your aircraft fires. It's a foam. And a foam basically separates the liquid fuel from the vapor, or blocks the vapor from expanding up in the air. And if you don't have any vapor and oxygen can't get to the fuel, then there's no opportunity for fire to start there. So foam is a good way to put a fire out. And they use this also outside of the fuel area, use it with the big airdrops. You got your slurry that drops from the airplanes that also can be an effective way to keep the fuel from burning. And so that separates, again, the fuel from the air and fuel from, if you will, ignition sources. So the foam's been applied in many different ways. You have slurry, you have actual Class A foams we use for brush fires. We can use them for dumpster fires and what have you. That allows people to condition the fuel to not burn. And so foam's been very, I guess, probably used in the last, I want to say 40 or 50 years, and been a very effective agent for your fuel spills, for also for large combustible and trash where we can't actually dig through it. We can actually load up with foam and keep it from burning. So foam's been very cool.
So did you have just another one or two of those protocols to talk about?
One more is weather disaster situations. This is something that was looked at in Europe. And basically Europe was looking at how the fire service deals with your large storms when it comes to vehicle collisions and other type of emergencies, wires down, what have you. So it's one of those things where it helps their fire responses, because their fire responses expanded, especially in Germany, to those type of emergencies, not only fires, but they do go on these other type of, if you will, safety or hazard conditions caused by a storm. Our protocol here is expanded into disaster situations, whether it's a flood or earthquake or what have you. This protocol is very appropriate for that. We kind of steered clear of this over the years as a Council of Standards, and we basically seen this as a agency managed event versus a dispatcher managed event. But we come to recognize over recent years that it starts with the first phone call. And sometimes those multiple calls coming in, agencies need to be able to address them better. So by having this protocol, it allows the dispatch agency at the initiation of the event, or even during the duration of the event, to be, even if they don't have resources to go to the event, they can actually triage the call to actually put it in some sort or order to when resources do come available, they can go ahead and send it out to that location for that event. So there is a way, if you will, for triaging resources needed for event, even though they're not available for that as well. So there's a lot of good bells and whistles on this chief complaint that people can use for those death situations, regardless of what the disaster is.
So is that a protocol that the dispatcher should use when somebody is reporting a bad weather event, or is it one that the dispatch center decides, okay, we're moving everything over to this chief complaint during the duration of this event?
Yes, it would have to be one you would go to once you know you have a large event. Let's say a tornado went through a community or what have you. This is the perfect one to go through. You know?
So then everything that comes into the center will go through that one chief complaint during the duration?
For that area that's affected.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not for reporting, I think there's a tornado. It's more for once we know we're in a bad situation, we're going to just triage everything through this protocol.
You know, that's a good point. Yeah, the impact will have had to occur and then use this protocol to identify now we have to deal with a disaster area.
And the agency gets to decide the conditions on which they would use that protocol?
They would probably use it for all calls coming in. Let me go ahead and read through the questions of this. So this is kind of telling on this when you ask for the key questions on this. It first talks about what type of incident is this. And we look at mass casualty, entrapment, immediate danger, critical infrastructure, non-critical infrastructure type events. So we're looking at those things impacted by a tornado or a flood, if you will, or some other hurricane or other weather disaster, or even earthquake as well. Mm-hmm. Then it goes on to ask, is anyone trapped? If so, how many? Exactly where are they located? Is anyone in immediate danger? And what danger they are, and if so, how many? Then it goes on to, is anyone injured? And if appropriate, what type of building structures involved? Can describe the extent of the damage and how many building structures are involved. So we're looking at a massive area that's damaged for us to triage the event of what people need and what to send out to those calls. Hmm. Okay. The dispatch descriptors start off with mass casualty incident, then entrapment trapped, then immediate danger, then critical infrastructure. Then it goes into a Charlie non-critical infrastructure, and then a Bravo medical problems stranded, utility related, and Alpha would be other situation, and Omega would be referral. So you're looking at the ability for the agency, okay, I've got this large expansive area, I got all these calls coming in, now I've got a Delta, I got a Bravo, I got a Charlie, I got a way to prioritize these calls to find out who gets the first care and how many people are hurt, whatever, so I can assess my triage, if you will, how many injuries I have and what kind of entrapment situations I have, what equipment needs to get out there for those events.
And it gives you that overall picture of the effect of the event on the whole area.
One caller at a time, right?
Right.
From the perspective of each caller saying, this is my plight here. Another caller comes in, they give a condition somewhere else, you know. And also you see the post-dispatch instructions for knowing that we may not get there in a timely manner. We're seeing now a compromised structure, make sure that everybody is out of the building and in a safe location. If they do so, remain there and not and move to a safe location if necessary. And if safe to do so, find transportation to the hospital or doctor. So we're looking at people that we're not going to get there in time, so to see if they can get there and provide care as well. And then we got connections now, how to shut off your natural gas, your propane gas. If you're going to be there for a while, try to eliminate the hazards if you can. And these instructions are different than we saw in California with earthquake preparation to make sure you know how to turn on your own gas, because the fire department's not going to get there for a while.
Right.
So best not let the gas get out there and hit an ignition source and cause a huge fire or explosion, you know, so that comes off of it as well. So it's a very good protocol. We're looking forward to the data we'll get from its use. And again, heaven forbid we have to use it, first of all. But let's say that it does occur, then we'll be able to pull some data and see how it works. Okay. But this is basically using the standards currently used in a lot of communities today.
Well, it's a good thing, I think, to give them the option to protocolize something that they're going to do anyway.
Right.
I mean, you were saying that you were just waiting for the agencies to kind of handle this on their own, but why not give them a protocol to use if we know what their situation is going to be?
Yeah, and again, any agency would be faced with these situations, right? And so we look in the realms of active shooter, and you look at the situations where you have the floodings and what have you. Now we're saying, yeah, there's a good way now where we don't have a situation where the rescuers are going to make the timely response and take care of the problem. It's the telecommuter, again, that's actually managing the event, giving the care, and identifying the priority of the events to help responders when they get there. So it's a whole different tact.
And that takes us back to the wildland fires that we were talking about. So the fires in California last year in particular, we saw some calls that maybe we hadn't really had examples of before, where I've heard you talking before about people calling who are surrounded by the fire or who weren't going to get a response. And so that led you to think a little bit more about what can you tell those people when they're in a situation where we can't send anybody?
You know, the public's been faced over the years at different situations where they've been trapped by wildland fire. You know, it's one of those things where we didn't recognize as a fire service the need to develop that, or maybe didn't see the need because it was those situations just couldn't get out of. It was going to happen. And I think what brought this to mind is a specific agency called REDCOM. They're out in Northern California, Sonoma County. And they're an agency we just implemented medical protocol in more recent years, the ProQA end of it. And they're going to go to fire protocol. And so they were faced with fires in that area last October that, as far as I know, historically in the United States, as far as wildland fires go, it was the highest casualty rate of civilians.
Wow.
I want to believe the number is somewhere in the area of 50 people killed in a wildland fire. And that's just unheard of for civilians. And so we were able to obtain from them a lot of audio files of people trapped in structure fires. And it was just awful. Now, at the same time, in the same six-month period, we saw the Thomas Fire in Southern California face the same devastation and same life threat as well. So there's been a number of fires over the years that have gotten to this point. But as we researched this event and tried to look at where the standards out there for the public to survive one of these, there are none anywhere. And so we had looked to the fire service and say, what do you tell your firefighters to do in order to survive a fire? Now, it's what I learned coming through the fire service in California, because we had a lot of interface area and wildland fires that we went to, being even a municipal fire department. But our council of research, Mike Thompson, who also chief officer from South Dakota, is very well versed on, if you will, wildland survival. And so we had our training, but we wanted to look to the national standards, so that's what we searched. Mm-hmm. And we found these basic instructions given to firefighters that we translated to give to lay people on how to survive their situation. And basically, if the person is outside, the first thing we do is, any of these situations, try to get out, get away from the fire, any way possible. If they cannot, then we have specific instructions if they're outside or in a building or in a car. And so we address those instructions in that format and way to survive that. And we found some situations that REDCOM proven just by, hey, can you get into a pool of water, for example? Can you get in a lake? Can you get in there? And these people survived. And so we looked at some of the fire instructions we have that gave the same type of instructions, and we just basically translated them into instructions that could be easily given over phone by the telecommunicator to help that person survive.
Are you ever telling people to do things like to go through a fire if they're surrounded completely? You're trying to get them to be in place in some safe, in the safest way possible?
Yeah, probably against your better judgment. We're telling them to stay in the structure, even if it catches on fire, and to the point where the inside becomes untenable, then you should escape. Make sure you're by the exit, for example, and you get out of the building. But there are some situations that can give buy you a little time, and hopefully that the fire will pass over you, and you can get out and go to what we call an area called the black, where the fire's already been, or into a water pool, if you will, swimming pool, what have you, to remain safe.
What is the amount of time that it takes for a wildland fire to pass by a particular area? It just depends?
That's the question.
Yeah.
Basically, it's fire load. Is it grass fire? It's going to be quickly. If it's going to be timber, it's going to be a long time passing. You know, they give firefighters those shelters, right? And so we're supposed to find a clearing and clear our way and have these little tents that we put up erect and let the fire pass over. But if the fire stays around us for a long period of time, then the tents won't provide that protection over a long period of time. On the short term, it will. But not knowing what the fuel load, we call it fuel load. That means what type of fuel is around you and how much of it. Depending on what the fuel load is, depending on whether you're surviving or not. The best thing you could be is in a clearing when put those up. But sometimes when you're fighting these wildland fires, there's no clearing around. You're in the woods. You're trying to cut a line, if you will, and trying to survive your events. So there's safety rules to follow, and sometimes they don't work.
But you're saying that there are events. There were events in the fires last year in which people were giving some of these sort of ad hoc instructions.
Yes.
And they did actually survive?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So there's some evidence, at least just anecdotally, that this might actually save lives in these events.
Yes, and don't forget, these are instructions given when all opportunity to get away from the emergency has failed. And so basically, these are the last resorts.
Is this a situation in which, in most cases, there's been an opportunity to evacuate that the person didn't take, or are they sometimes just moving so fast that there's no opportunity?
That's what surprised so much in the fire service, and for me personally, is the fact we've never seen so many fatalities like this. And what we saw as I got information I got from the fire representatives I talked to out there is the fact the fire was started in one area and the winds were so fierce. It blew the fire in areas miles away where even the fire service didn't get reports to 911 the fire was occurring. So here I am in my home and I see on the far distance area a plume of smoke where a fire is occurring. Typical fire environment, typical wind environment. Well, there it stays and it's that far away, so I feel pretty safe. Now, if this wind's blowing embers and fire all around a huge area. You got surprise fire coming up your back hill, and you're looking over here, and you got fire coming to your left, fire coming to your right. Pretty soon, you're surrounded. So that's the problem they ran into, is the fact that the fire was spreading so rapidly and actually causing more fires because of the wind. One of the stories told by one of the battalion chiefs there, he says he pulled his vehicle on a hill to do some investigation, and he says the winds were so fierce, it took him to put his feet against his console of his car and push his body against the door to open it. That's how strong the winds were. And so when you look that kind of wind pushing fire around, I mean, there's no fire there for the moment, but within moments, another fire will start and all of a sudden you're surrounded. So it's not a surprise they were faced with that, but it's so unusual to have that fierce of winds and that type of terrain and that type of that time of year and that dry fuel, if you will, to spread so quickly and catch people by surprise. It's just amazing, and in a very bad, horrid way that that the fire spread so quickly and those people lost their lives.
But now we have at least something that we can provide to them, even in those worst case scenarios.
Yes.
And if I have heard this correctly, I think that we had something similar or a similar type of incident that informed the new structure fire PAIs.
Yes. Yes, we have. Actually, what started this, again, I go back to my research counsel, Mike Thompson, and we've had some requests from the agencies to be more specific in how we tell people to evacuate from a building. So we actually use some good rules, if you will, and some good directions on how to get out of any building. Mm-hmm. So we're not saying just find your way out. Here's how to find your way out. You know, we tell them specific what to do to evacuate the building safely, right? But in a situation, let's say a person cannot evacuate safely, the smoke in the hallway, the flames, whatever, keeps them in a location, the current protocol, 6.1, has instruction, has for the last couple versions, how to shelter in place. You know, how to basically keep the door sealed off with rags, wet rags and what have you, and how to open the window just enough to get air and to be able to lay low, if you will, in that room and survive that. But what if that doesn't work? What if that fire gets into that room? What do you do? And so we started working on the escape of last resort for a structure fire, you know. And again, we went to what we learned in the fire service. So the first effort is to find, is there escape out of that room? So another doorway that you can check and see. Feel for the door. Make sure it's safe to go through that doorway. If not, then go to a window. Is there someplace you can escape to from that window? Is there a balcony? Is there a ledge outside that you can get to? You know, can you get through that window? What if it has a lock cage, those security bars around it? What do you do? Those instructions had to be put there as well. If you get to the window and there's something to jump to, are you below are you second story or lower? And if so, then hang out and drop, you know, and survive it, because we found from the research being done that people not likely will be injured to a point of being killed from that fall. They may have some injuries, but it won't be severe injuries. However, if you go above the third floor, then you don't want to drop. You want to hang out the window, make yourself known. However, that not working, then we use actual rescue process for firefighters is what we call breaking through the wall or breaching the wall. And so we actually tell the caller how they can actually break through a wall and feel their way through and make sure the fire's not on their side to get to their side to actually escape the room, if the room seems to be more, if you will, less impacted by the fire than the room you're in.
So we talked a little bit about the structure fire and the wildland fire PAIs. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else new in the protocol that you definitely want to talk about?
I got to tell you, there's so many bells and whistles in this protocol. It's just wonderful. So we looked at the situation where you have backcountry rescue, where there's avalanche rescue. Well, what if you do have an avalanche that strikes you and the people you're with and you happen to be unaffected by it? Can you get to other people that were covered? Can you do any search techniques? And those search techniques are included.
So there are actually instructions for the techniques for them to search the area?
Yes. Yes, if they know where somebody's at, what to do, what to consider as far as taking a chance versus not taking a chance, what they actually can do, because we're talking about hours maybe before resources get there. So maybe they'll save a life if they can get to somebody and they happen to be in the right circumstance. Same things for somebody that's rope climbing, hanging off a cliff or whatever. What can that person do to stabilize them?
So you're talking about using the fire dispatcher to transmit really rescue practices that have previously been known only to the fire service or the rescuers directly to people who are on the scene.
Yes. And we're saying in these situations for backcountry, we're talking about it'll be hours, maybe a day, maybe 2 days before somebody gets out to them to help them. So is there some way they can stay safe or keep people safe or survive their plight?
And what are some of the instructions that you provide, like for lost people, for example, if they're out in the middle of nowhere, they don't know where they are, what can you tell those people?
Well, we tell them basically seek shelter, stay out of the sun, hydrate, keep their phone, don't use your power on your phone, because we need to reach you. Those kind of circumstances for communications and for survival. Just very simple instructions for that.
And what are some of the other backcountry rescue type situations? You're talking about avalanches, you're talking about climbing. What else might that be used for?
Well, again, anybody that's injured out there, they're hiking or whatever, and they got somebody injured and dealing with the situation, whatever the situation, because you can imagine being in the backcountry, all the things you'd face out there, depending on the weather and depending on the terrain as well, that put the person in a position where they could not, if you will, self-extricate, move to safety, what have you.
If an agency has the medical protocol and the fire protocol, and maybe this is probably not an official answer to this question, but let's say that there's a backcountry fall and, you know, you have a pretty serious fall because a lot of falls in the backcountry have high falls, things like that. And you know it's in the backcountry. Do you think that it would be probably more use for them to go to the fire backcountry protocol to figure out exactly the locations and what they're going to need to send and use those instructions, or to start with the medical falls protocol?
Again, when you look at the academy, you look at what they've strove to do. Safety is number one. And so when you look at rescue events or emergency events, whether they be in the urban or suburban or backcountry area, you want to mitigate the emergency or deal with emergency first before you deal with the medical problem. Because you want the person calling to be safe before they pursue something, if you will. So in the environment that we're talking about, academy is a standard. We'll always say safety over medical. So you stabilize the scene, police, if that's the event first. Stabilize the scene, fire, if that's the event first. And then once that's secured, then you can go to medical and give instructions.
Right. So you definitely don't want to send this other person who's calling into a dangerous situation to just see if the person is okay or something like that.
Yeah. And when you look at the situation again for these like disaster situations or backcountry rescue or whatever, you do have ability to send resources to that. So you've identified what the problem is, what needs to go on the call. So again, the priority of identifying what to send is there. At the same time, what initial steps can they take to, even though somebody's not injured, to maybe help them survive their situation? So we're not talking about a medical event necessarily, but something that that either precautionary or secure-wise to be able to take care of them at that point. Now, once that's been taken care of and you have a medical problem, maybe appropriately go to medical instructions to give specific care.
Anything else you want to add about the new protocol?
Well,
I know there's a lot in there.
There is a lot in there, and we're really excited about what we're doing here. We did, and as you mentioned about medical things, we did add in bleed control and burn care in the fire protocol. We kind of breached the medical line, if you will, those circumstances where we're dealing with the situation, safety, so to actually control bleeding or what have you in some circumstances is really appropriate. But we're finding, you'll find most of the chief complaints have some change on it. It's just amazing how much has occurred in the protocol. And we're seeing some of the things we've seen that coming out in version 13.1, like the subchief complaints coming in the case entry. So you'll see some of that as well. And there's other things that we'll see with that. Just a lot of good things occurring in the protocol. And we think people will really like it.
Then the two most important questions probably are, when is it coming out and where can people find more information about it?
Right now, it's being beta tested.
Okay.
I believe there's at least 8 agencies that are beta testing it. I just talked to one of the project managers in producing the protocol, Jay Dornsey. He actually worked with the Council of Standards and works with all the proofing of sheets. He knows every bit of the GHB in this protocol. And he told me that they're coming up with the final draft for the card sets. So that will start production. And then we'll see the software, if you will, some tweaks being done to that as the beta testing is being proved out on that as well. So our target when we looked at the actual release of this was July of 2018. It may stretch into September, but we're looking at during those times, we'll see that. Now, don't forget the update guide will accompany it. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see the update guide. I don't know if the DVD is going to be produced with that or not. But obviously, the other card sets, the software, the manuals for version 7, teaching version 7 protocol, all that has to be produced. So that does take time. Mm-hmm. We're already at the beginning of July, so we're saying maybe September that we'll see something.
But that's coming up really soon.
It is coming up soon. We're very excited about it.
So I have just one more question for you, which is, as you're thinking toward version 8.0 and 10.0 and 15 or whatever eventually, what do you see as the future of the FHIR protocol?
Wow, that's a good question. We like to be driven by our users. I think we gain a lot from their using the protocol. So we were very much inspired with this version, with what people brought forward and the circumstance that brought to us where we've never faced before as far as protocol developers. So, and as far as service is concerned, as much as that's changing, the standards change, we change with them. So it's hard to say at this point where NFPA is going to go, where ISO is going to go, where we see, if you will, the emergencies take us that may open the doors to new way of doing things. So I'm looking forward to even more evolving of the protocol itself and maybe more chief complaints. We're kind of joking about the fact now we guys made chief complaints of the medical card set, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
We've kind of become mature now with the medical card sets having a 25-year lead on us. So
right. So
we're thinking we're catching up with them slowly but surely. But we're really happy about what's produced, and we're looking forward to anything that comes up. And I want to encourage any listeners out there as well that you are part of our next version. So when you see the protocol and you see something that we're not seeing from an international standard, that you please let us know what we should maybe change, maybe should look at. Again, we need some justification with that in the PFC. So send us audio tape, give us the data, we'll get through it, and please contribute. Because again, most of the changes you'll see in version 7 came from you, the users. So please contribute.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Dispatch In Depth. Remember, it really helps us if you rate and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. Dispatch In Depth is hosted by me, Isabel Gardett. Our producer is Becca Barris. Reading Roberts is the technical director, and Scott Robinson is our executive producer.